At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Jobs, and then a little more jobs, because honestly, today's unemployment report was kind of a biggie, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, October the 3rd. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And how about that, y'all? 5.9% unemployment. As you've been hearing all day, no doubt, that is the lowest the jobless rate has been in six years. 248,000 new jobs added to the economy last month. It is, of course, where we will start today and our look back at the week that was. Here for that, we've got Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, Felix Salmon from Fusion. They are both in our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hello.
All right, Felix, knowing as I do how much you hate Jobs Day happy talk, let me ask you this. Find me the downside to this bad boy, would you? Find me the bad news.
The bad news, I guess, is that we're actually earning less than we were. The earnings are not up. So, I mean, some people think that's good news because it means that there's no inflationary pressures. I think it's bad news because it means that the people who are out there working are not getting the raises they want and need.
All right. Well, we'll get to that whole inflation side of this thing in a minute with Mitchell Hartman right after we talk. But Catherine, same question to you. Downside, the dark side of this thing.
Yeah. I mean, the downside was definitely the hourly earnings numbers, that you have people who have just have stagnant wages. I mean, you have more people getting jobs, which is nice, but the people who are already employed are just not seeing raises.
All right. So I've got my own downside, and I want to bounce this around off of you two guys. We are now told that the jobs recovery is finally robust, right? And that the economic recovery, which is 5.5 years old, is finally robust. Felix, 5.5 years is a long time for an economic recovery.
I know. You're kind of looking at your watch wondering,
right.
Well, you know, is it about time for the economy to start going down again?
That's what I'm
saying. These things are cyclical, right?
Well, and Catherine?
I don't think we're on the verge of another recession, if that's the question. But yes, it is very disappointing that it's taken this long for us to have relatively, quote unquote, robust job growth. You know, for years after the recession was over, in fact, we still had job losses. And then even when those job numbers turned positive, they were still not positive enough to put everybody back to work.
We still have this enormous, what's known as an outputs gap. The amount that the economy produces is still way too low compared to the amount that it could and should be producing if it was really firing on all cylinders.
Do you think, Felix, that this jobs report comes at a time when it will do President Obama any good? He is now trying, as you know, with that speech yesterday, desperately to turn the conversation back to the economy and how it's a good thing.
I think it's, you know, it's a sign that whatever economic policies he's managed to get through have maybe working. But frankly, I would give most of the credit to the Fed rather than to President Obama. The fiscal policy, the stuff which he's in charge of, has been bad. Remember, we still have that sequester in place.
You know what I love? I love how everybody has forgotten the sequester, right? You go out there and they're like, wait, what? You know? You're like, come on, man. Catherine, about the Federal Reserve, do you think today's jobs report changes the timing on raising of interest rates at all?
You know, I saw some notes from economists today who suggested that maybe we'll see rates go up a little bit earlier, like in the spring, perhaps, than had been previously expected. But I'm not really convinced about that. I mean, we're just now winding down quantitative easing.
Right.
And Janet Yellen, amongst others, have mentioned that they're not just looking at the unemployment rate. They're also looking at, you know, what share of Americans are quitting their jobs voluntarily, how long it's taking to fill openings, things like that. So today's report, while, you know, for the most part quite positive, is not going to suddenly change the game, the calculus.
She's also looking very closely at this thing called the labor force participation rate,
right,
which hit another new low, I think the lowest it's been since 1978. We have many, many fewer people working in the economy now as a percentage of the total workforce, workforce.
Right. But isn't there all kinds of research out there saying, you know, that or stuff that's coming up now saying that's not cyclical. That's just kind of the way the demographics in this country are going, right?
Well, it's partly demographic.
Yeah.
But it's also partly that even young people, you know, or people under retirement age are not putting themselves out there and applying for jobs and saying that they actually are looking for work. So it's not just demographics.
Right. Catherine Rempel from The Washington Post, Felix Salmon from Fusion. Have a good weekend, you guys.
You too.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we'll see you. Wall Street Today. Well, you saw that jobs number, right? The happy music will still be upon us. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We talked a bit, Felix, Catherine, and I, about what today's jobs report might mean for Janet Yellen, the Federal Reserve, and interest rates, at least timing-wise. And while the news was good today, Dr. Yellen and her colleagues will be looking for a dark lining in the silver cloud, inflation, and the worry that as unemployment falls, prices will rise. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
There's a pretty simple idea in economics. As unemployment falls, wages start to rise. Michael Strain is an economist at the American Enterprise Institute. He says it's based on supply and demand.
If there are fewer unemployed workers around, then workers are relatively more scarce, and companies have to be more competitive to attract workers. And the way that they compete is by offering higher wages.
Economic models say this happens when the economy hits a certain threshold called the natural rate of unemployment. Right now, that's thought to be around 5.5%, which is why inflation hawks say wages and prices could accelerate soon. Except, says UCLA economist Roger Farmer,
there are currently no signs of wage inflation reemerging.
That may be because there are a lot of people who have dropped out of the workforce. They aren't counted as unemployed, but many do want jobs. Others are working part-time but want full-time work, explains Douglas Holtz Aiken at the American Action Forum.
If, as the unemployment rate goes down, some of those people flood back in, well, that slack takes some of the pressure off the inflation process.
Also, says economist Mark Cooperberg at Swarthmore College, employers could pay workers more without raising their prices. That's because with new technology, we're worth more than we used to be.
It's like I became twice as productive. I started producing twice as much per hour, but I was only paid 50% more, not 100% more. So there, I could, in principle, be paid that other 50%, and there still would be no inflation pressure.
All reasons why a lot of economists now think we could have significantly lower unemployment without setting off the scary spiral of inflation. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The latest hack of consumer data in this country is, and this is, I will tell you an understatement, a doozy. Information on 76 million households and another 7 million small businesses hoovered right off the computer network at JPMorgan Chase, which is, as it happens, this country's biggest bank. The original estimate, which we learned about last month, was that just a couple of million records were compromised. JPMorgan now says there is no evidence hackers got a hold of account information, just names and addresses and emails and phone numbers. So, yeah, there's that going for it. Marketplace's David Gura has more now on how exactly a bank figures out the extent of a hack and what might happen next for all those customers.
Companies often learn data have been breached from third parties. Anton Shavakin is a risk analyst with the research firm Gartner. He says law enforcement will call if they spot stolen data on underground forums.
Oh, by the way, we are seeing your data here. What's up with that?
These days, big banks spend big on their own security. J.P. Morgan has allocated $250 million. When a bank discovers a breach,
you're going to have a big senior management powwow.
Julie Conroy covers data security for the Aite Group. Management will put into place what's called a security incident response plan.
And the forensic analysis is very much like what you see at a crime scene.
It's methodical, and according to Martin Lindner, a cybersecurity specialist at Carnegie Mellon University, banks keep logs on everything that happens on their servers.
So in theory, they can go back to all those logs, replay them, and see what happened that was the thing that appears to be nefarious.
It's a lot of information, and going through that is time-consuming. Forensics is just one part of the security incident response plan. There's also remediation and communication. With this breach, tens of millions of people are at risk, even though J.P. Morgan says there's no evidence sensitive account information was compromised. Lawrence Baxter is a law professor at Duke. He says hackers could use what they've gathered to fish for more information using, say, an official-looking email message.
And you may only get a half of 1% of the customer base fooled by it, but that's enough
to cause more damage to customers' bank accounts and also to the bank's reputation. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When I was a kid, I fell off of the roof of a house, and it seemed to take a very long time. It seemed like the whole event sort of went in slow motion.
Numbers and time and how we perceive them. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 208 points on what was actually a lost week. 1 2/10% ended at 17,009. The NASDAQ gained back 45 points, 1%, 4475. The S&P 500 added 21 points, 1.1%, finished at 1967. For the week, the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P all slipped just under 0.1%. Big banks led the rally today. Goldman Sachs added 2.8%. J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America tacked on 2 4/10%. Another IPO to tell you about today, this one in the sand business. Yes, sand. FMSA Holdings, it mines the sand used in fracking. Shares at the close were right about where they started. The yield on the 10-year T-note unchanged on this Friday, 2.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Fortune's Most Powerful Women's Summit gets underway in Laguna Niguel, California. Nobel Prize season begins with the announcement for the award in physiology or medicine. Of the 204 laureates in this category, only 10 have been women. And she was the first woman to receive the American Film Institute's Life Achievement Award. Screen legend Betty Davis died on October 6, 1989. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Gone Girl opened today. I know you've seen the TV ads and the billboards. Ben Affleck starring in the adaptation of Gillian Flynn's book. It'll top the box office this weekend, no doubt, and there is Oscar buzz about the thing to boot. But back to that adaptation part for just a minute. If you are the type who pays attention to movie credits, you will notice Flynn's name in there for adapting the screenplay from her own book. Yes, books do get made into films all the time, but it is still unusual for the author to write the movie. Marketplace's Adrian Hill looked into why that is.
It's a big weekend for novelists-turned-screenwriters at the movies. There's Gone Girl, like Kai just mentioned, The Drop, a crime drama by Dennis Lehane, and This Is Where I Leave You, author Jonathan Tropper's star-studded story of a dysfunctional family.
Is that adapting your own book for a film is kind of like doing surgery on your own child?
Tropper says rewriting his novel for the screen was a long and painful process, but he wanted to do it himself.
You know, you get protective of these characters and of these stories, and you don't like to see people, even really good writers, you just don't really want to see them, you know, take your stuff apart.
There can also be money for authors in these deals, but Hollywood typically shrugs them off.
The studio or the production company will frequently prefer to have it adapted by a well-known, proven screenwriter.
Robert Zipser is a Hollywood entertainment attorney. Writing for print and the screen, he says, are just different skills. Also, says Zipser, with a known film writer, there's a better chance the movie will actually get made.
The involvement of an A-list screenwriter can often help attract cast and the director to the movie.
For authors that still want to elbow their way onto the set, literary agent Rebecca Friedman says there's no better leverage than a bestseller like Gone Girl.
The more successful the book is, the more likely it is that the author will get to write the screenplay.
It also doesn't hurt if you know your way around the script. Tropper and Lehane both have TV credits. In the end, studios want to minimize risk. And the success of a few movies isn't going to change that story. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Today, in completely depressing energy industry news, there is this. If you work in North Dakota, in the booming, booming, booming oil and natural gas fields out there, you are three times as likely to get killed on the job as you are if you work in oil and gas someplace else. So today on part two of our series, Dark Side of the Boom, Emily Guerin from Prairie Public Broadcasting looks into why North Dakota is so dangerous.
There are lots of ways to die in North Dakota's oil and gas industry.
An employee was killed after being struck by a set of power tongs on a drilling rig.
That's Jordan Wurfsbrock. She's a data journalist here at Inside Energy. She's reading from a list of oil and gas fatalities in North Dakota in the last 2 years.
He burst into flame and died as a result of burn injuries.
In 2013, 11 oil and gas workers died. According to the latest data available, North Dakota has the highest oil and gas worker fatality rate in the country. Part of the problem is the industry's risk-taking culture. The street in front of Arnie's Motorcycles in Williston, North Dakota is crawling with trucks. There's semis hauling water and muddy pickup trucks carrying oil field workers. Deanne Clark sells a lot of bikes and ATVs to the same guys driving those trucks down the street.
Well, they just kind of tear off out into the street, and, oh, that one will be back, we're thinking. All wrecked up, and sometimes they are.
Teresa Van Dusen sees the effects of that overconfidence all the time in her job as a safety specialist for WPX Energy, a large oil company here.
They have the go-get-em kind of attitude that, you know, oh, I can do that. I can do this little shortcut. Well, when you're working with the pressures and the dangers that are inherent to the oil field, you can't do shortcuts.
I met Teresa at a meeting of industry safety professionals. I asked people there why North Dakota's oil industry was so dangerous. Here's what safety consultant Scott Rogers had to say.
The experience level of our entry-level employee is significantly lower than the individuals and the companies that I visit with in Texas or Colorado.
Another factor, not a lot of safety inspections. Here's Dennis Schmitz, a safety expert who organized this meeting.
Probably almost better odds of winning a lottery than getting a visit from a regulatory agency.
And the biggest issue? Pretty much every dangerous job on an oil well is contracted out to smaller companies. Big oil companies like WPX Energy aren't responsible. So I asked Teresa Van Dusen of WPX Energy this question.
Is there anything that, you know, operators can do to help these smaller contractors be safer?
Wow. I don't know how to answer the question. We do everything that we can. Obviously, that is the drilling company's employee.
North Dakota's governor, Jack Dalrymple, says the state's safety programs are working. But he also acknowledges the problem, something I hadn't heard from him before. He says he'll get his top safety and health officials together.
Where I would just turn to them and I say, I want a report on what we're doing about fatalities in the workforce. And I want to know if there's any way we can do it better. And I think because of this interview, I will probably be doing that at our next meeting.
Could this be the beginning of North Dakota's efforts to make oil and gas work safer? As they say in AA, admitting you have a problem is the first step. In North Dakota, I'm Emily Guerin for Marketplace.
Emily's story and our series, Dark Side of the Boom, is a project of Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration focused on this country's energy issues. We've got, as I think I've mentioned a couple of times on the radio now, a live road show that we have been doing across the country this year. It's called How We Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. We were down in Houston, Texas earlier this week, and I want to play one of the interviews that we did on stage on what I guess it was Tuesday night. It's about a little bit of the science that underpins the numbers and how we think about them, how our brains measure and create our reality. David Eagleman is a neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. He is a best-selling author. He's got a PBS television series coming next year. It is called The Brain. And that's what I asked him about, how our brains perceive the world. Here you go. Here's the tape.
Great to be here. Thanks, Guy.
Is that a fair supposition, a fair statement of fact, right? We deal with the numbers in the hard world, and you sort of deal with how we perceive all this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Everything about our reality is a construction of the brain. And so this is what I study in my laboratory, how brains construct reality.
How do you do that?
Sometimes it's by dropping people from a 150-foot tall tower to see how
are
long.
Are you allowed to do that?
Yeah, that was actually the hardest thing I ever did in science was get approval to do that experiment.
I can't imagine why. That's remarkable. Okay, so it is actually this thing called the perceptual chronometer.
Yeah.
Right? Explain that to me, because it's just a cool experiment, and then I want to talk numbers.
When I was a kid, I fell off of the roof of a house, and it seemed to take a very long time. It seemed like the whole event sort of went in slow motion.
Right.
When I got to high school and I learned physics, I calculated that the whole fall took 0.8 of a second, but it didn't feel that way. And that's what got me really interested in the perception of time and how we experience it. So the experiment that I did some years ago is I dropped people from a 150-foot tall tower in free fall.
Yeah.
And they were caught by a net below, going about 70 miles an hour. And I developed this thing called the perceptual chronometer, which flashes numbers at you in a particular way so that I can measure the speed at which you're seeing the world. So I could figure out whether people were actually seeing in slow motion, like Neo in The Matrix,
yeah,
or whether it was just a trick of memory retrospectively. And it turns out that it's a trick of memory. In other words, when you're in a car accident and you see, oh gosh, the hood crumpled and the rearview mirror fell off, it's all that you're laying down memories more densely. So when you read that back out, you think, wow, it must have taken a really long time. So that's what I discovered from the perceptual chronometer.
And you are dealing in periods of time in, I guess, millions of seconds, right? I mean,
yeah,
milliseconds. Thousands of seconds, right?
Thousands
of seconds.
Yeah.
My guess is you have at least heard of, if not read, Michael Lewis's most recent book, Flash Boys.
Is that about the high-frequency training?
Yeah.
I haven't read it, but I know about it.
And it's about these guys, these traders, who are locating their physical trading centers closer and closer and closer to the center of the trading action so they can save milliseconds. Are we now at the point where our daily lives in the markets, in car crashes, whatever it is, need to be measured that way? Because I don't think we can all process that stuff.
Well, this is the very strange part, is that we're now building all these systems that can operate so much more quickly than we can. Yeah, everything in that high-frequency trading world used to run at the millisecond time scale. Now it's at the microsecond time scale. It's happening at a scale that we can't perceive. And maybe someday we'll fight our wars that way. We'll have drones fighting. World War III will be over in a tenth of a second, and we'll see who won.
Okay, great. Or terrible. I don't know.
I don't know either.
As you study this stuff, I wonder what you think of the mantra that goes, and this is, so I have a rule that goes like this. If you think about how you sound on the radio when you are on the radio, you will screw up how you sound on the radio, inevitably, right? Which is why you hear me talk the way I do on the radio. I wonder what you think of this idea, dealing as you do in perceptions of reality. You just got to go with it, man, and just kind of wing it.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Because sometimes when you start reaching your...
Where's my boss? My boss is out there somewhere, and I don't know what she's saying about this.
The fact is that when you start reaching your arms, too deep into this issue about how weird reality is out there, it just gets too much. And the fact is we've evolved to operate on a very particular scale of space and time and to care about particular things like, you know, finding a mate and finding food and drink and things that matter to us. And all of this other stuff, we can go in the laboratory and study it every day, but it's in the end, we have to keep it removed from how we actually live our lives.
Well, and on that, just to get it back to sort of marketplace and what we do, can consumers process this stuff? I mean, there's so much information coming at us, right? So let's not talk time. Let us talk quantity of information. How do we as consumers in this society, a $17 trillion economy, process all this stuff in a way that makes sense?
Yeah, the only thing that functions here, I think, is what's called the illusion of truth effect, which is if you hear something enough times, you start to believe it's true. This is an old psychological finding. So it's lousy that it turns out that way, but there's no way to keep up with all the info. I just read a statistic yesterday that in every minute of time, there are 6,000 minutes of new YouTube videos uploaded.
Right.
So
what are we supposed to do with that?
Yeah.
There's more stuff out there than there are minutes in the day.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I've been thinking about lately is I'm going to reach a certain point in my life where the amount of time I have left to live will be insufficient to go through all the digital photos I've taken.
David Eagleman, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
The next stop for our road show, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers, is New York City, October the 16th at the 92nd Street Y. We'll be live on stage with ballerina Misty Copeland, author Delia Ephron, to name just a couple, a slew of marketplace reporters as well. You can see what we look like. Tickets at 92y.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer has apparently figured out what she wants to do with some of the billions of dollars her company made from the Alibaba IPO a couple of weeks ago. There are reports today Yahoo is going to take a stake in Snapchat. That's the app that lets users send messages that disappear after just a couple of seconds. No word on exactly how much it'll be, but it does value the startup at $10 billion. And yes, insert your own joke here. Yahoo, a company arguably on the ropes, buying a company that makes things disappear. Ba-doom, boom. All right. You can hear the music. That means we got to go. The Dow up 208 points today, 1.2%. The NASDAQ climbed 45 points, 1%. The S&P 500 added 21 points, 1.1%. Although it was, I will tell you, slightly a rough week. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.